still in there. He liked to feel good. "That's right, Buster," she muttered, feeling her own cheeks burn, and sat back down. She glanced up at him, a bit abashed at herself, at the sight below, at her forwardness with him, at the strength of her sudden memories breaking out like the black torrent. "Think it over," she said. "Be ready for it. Get all your ducks in a row."
"Among those ducks would be members of Congress I could count on," he remarked as he sat down.
He was smiling his little smile.
"Dessert?"
"Yes," she said uneasily. "Dessert and cognac."
"Indeed."
New York's big avenues are not oriented exactly north and south, but are angled 29 degrees to the east of north. This means the east to west streets are actually angled northwest to southeast. This explains why the so-called Manhattan Henge days, when sunsets align with the streets and pour down them out of the west, turning the canals to fire, occur not on the equinoxes, but rather around May 28 and July 12. A storm that swept down from the Arctic in 1932 brought Arctic birds called dovekies and dashed many of them against the skyscrapers. Thousands were found all over the city, dead, bodies draped on telephone wires, in streets, lakes, and lawns. Federal Writers Project, 1938.
H. The Citizen Redux. If the Earth's atmosphere were compressed to the density of water, it would form a coating on the Earth about 30 feet thick. As it is, it extends some 11 miles into the sky and then gets very diffuse above that, shifting from the troposphere to the stratosphere. As far as human year-round habitation, that habitable zone reaches up some 15,000 feet, so say 3 miles. Above that, people tend to die. So think about a layer of cellophane wrapping a basketball, and then remember that you're still thinking too thick when it comes to the atmosphere and the Earth. Meanwhile, it's air, quite tenuous compared to water, and easy to move around over the surface of the Earth, as the Earth spins like a top in its circling of the sun. One spin a day, which is what a day is, duh, gets you a surface speed at the equator of about 1,000 miles an hour. So really, the wonder is that the air remains as still as it does, but inertia, drag, etc., means that usually the jet streams top out at around 100 miles an hour, pouring mostly eastwards, in patterns not unlike water coming out of the end of a hose left on the ground. In other words, chaotic patterns, but clustered around strange attractors so that there are, in fact, patterns. It's light stuff, air, and though it moves somewhat like ocean currents as it flows around the Earth, its motion is wilder. This has always been true, but when you add heat to the system, everything has more energy, and so it behaves like it did before, but even more so. So weather has always been wild and full of anomalies, but after the rise in global temperatures following the massive release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere by humanity's industrial civilization, weather got even wilder. For a long time, there was 0.6 watt per square meter more energy coming to the Earth than was leaving, and this cooked things, and the pot began to boil. Note that this new energy doesn't disallow cold events just because the average is hotter. The increase in energy increases also the violence of the whirlpools of air that form, and a big enough whirlpool whirls the air itself away from its center, making a low-pressure area, and the land under that absence of air can become stupendously cold. So, stormy weather of all kinds, including hurricanes, cyclones, tornadoes, lightning storms, blizzards, droughts, heat spells, downpours, cold fronts, high pressure ridges, and so on. You get the picture. So, in the 22nd century, all over the world, people were taking shots of extreme weather that wrecked whatever they had built, including the crops they were growing and the soil they grew it in. At sea level, raised to its current height just 40 years before, the tenuous, brittle, fragile rebuilding efforts of humanity and all other living species were particularly vulnerable to superstorms in the new categories established, sometimes called Class 7, or Force 11, or Motherfucker Supreme. In the tropics, a lot of construction had been dubious to begin with, and with the added storm intensities, the ramshackle nature of the post-pulse reconstruction, new weather events could simply smash coastal cities to smithereens. Confirm Manila 2128, Jakarta 2134, Honolulu 2137. These were extremely sobering examples of the death and destruction now possible when an overwhelming storm hit an underwhelming infrastructure. New York, it has to be said, compared to most coastal cities of the world, has an infrastructure like a brick shithouse. It is set in rock and built of steel and various composites so strong that the rock is often the first thing to break. But rock does break, and not all the city is equally built to code. A lot of ad hocery in the various recovery and renovations made in the submerged zones and the intertidal. So it is not invulnerable. No human construct is. Then recall also, if your retention still allows such a feat after so many dense pages, the peculiar geography of the Bight of New York relative to the Atlantic and the globe entire. Hurricanes, more violent than ever before, swirl up from the Caribbean, or really the horse latitudes, and as they move north at a medium speed, they spin counterclockwise when seen from space, such that the winds in the leading edge of the storm are pushing westward and can be extraordinarily fast and powerful. Then recall the topography of the Bight. Also, the way that New York is an archipelago of islands in an estuary, with the Narrows connecting the estuary to the Atlantic at the bend point of the Bight, with a back door also on the east side of the estuary where Long Island Sound connects to the East River by way of Hellgate. What it adds up to is a recipe for a storm surge, yes indeed. A monster hurricane shoves a great deal of the Atlantic north and east into the Bight. New Jersey banks all that slug of water through the Narrows, and more gets shoved hard east along Long Island Sound until it floods through Hellgate into the East River. Meanwhile, the Hudson never stops draining a rather immense watershed, pouring its own flow down from the north, a flow that can max as high as 200,000 cubic feet per second. Thus, a moment in a hurricane comes when water is coming into the bay from three directions, and there is nowhere for it to go but up. If by chance all this happens in a neap tide, it even gets a tug from the moon, such that upward becomes, in effect, the path of least resistance. So, up the water goes. Storm surge of 2046 is Hurricane Alfred, 18 feet. Big disaster. Hurricane Sandy in 2012, storm surge of 12 feet, big disaster. Storm surge for the unnamed hurricane of 1893, 30 feet. Utter wreckation. And now, recall, and this you should be capable of, as it is the overriding omnipresent fact of life on Earth today, that sea level is already 50 feet higher than it was pre-pulse. Add a storm surge to this pre-existing condition, and what do you get? You'll only find out when it happens.
96 premature babies were brought to the Infant Incubator Company building at the 1939 World's Fair to live their first few weeks there. Shall we not have sympathy with the muskrat, which gnaws its third leg off, not as pitying its sufferings, but through our kindred mortality, appreciating its majestic pains and its heroic virtue? Are we not made its brothers by fate? For whom are psalms sung and mass said, if not for such worthies as these? Thoreau.
I, Stefan and Roberto. The late spring days got longer, and the rooftops burst all green. Every living thing budded, and the turbid water smelled like shit. the intertidal oozing goo and reeking at low tide, its slimy mud stippled by oyster beds and old dock pilings. The Great Bay was so crowded with boats that the traffic lanes for big ships were well defined by the absence of little boats in them. Sun blazed off water from the half hour after dawn to the half hour before sunset, and close to shore the dark blue of the rivers turned black with silt or yellow with runoff, or prismatic with leaking gas and oil. The humidity was so great that the air grew visible, a fetid white mist weighing on the city, and the idea that just a couple months before the bay had been ice, and the air like liquid nitrogen seemed incredible. Climate in the city, always notorious, a scandal, had in the 22nd century gone nova. Now the luminous, miasmatic summers ranged from subtropical to supertropical, and the mosquitoes were bloodthirsty and disease-laden. The concrete chess tables grew as hot to the touch as ovens. People stayed indoors, or if they had to go out, stumbled or boated around stunned and appalled, feeling there must be a fire somewhere nearby. No one could quite believe that this city of dreams could veer so melodramatically, like a sky village flitting from pole to equator to pole in a matter of weeks. People begged for a blizzard. Stefan and Roberto didn't care. They were on a mission to locate Herman Melville's grave, and maybe haul the gravestone back to the Madison Square Pacino and mount it as a dock piling on the Met Dock, at its northeast corner closest to where Melville had lived. That was their plan, and they were sticking to it. Mr. Hexter had told them that the gravestone was big, possibly a 4-foot by 4-foot slab of granite, certain to weigh hundreds of pounds, but they weren't going to let that stop them. They had borrowed a dock dolly when no one was looking, and their boat rode very high on the water. If worse came to worst, they could figure out the transport issues after they located it. So this was in the nature of a reconnaissance, and they were happy motoring across the shallows of the Bronx, on the hunt again, dodging nasty roof reefs and blobs of black glop floating on the surface with the seaweed. The drowned Bronx was almost as extensive as the drowned parts of Brooklyn and Queens, which was saying a lot. Its current shoreline slurped many blocks north of where it had used to be, and old creek ravines and even a substantial river valley had refilled, splitting the borough with a couple north-south bays, the west one running right up to Yonkers, drowning the old Van Cortlandt Park and sloshing at high tide up and over Woodlawn Cemetery. But not over Melville. Nautical rider though he had been, his grave still stood on dry land, many graves in from the high tide line. Mr. Hexter had determined this with his maps and assured them it had to be true. At first they were disappointed it wasn't underwater, but as they had given over their diving bell to Vlade, they became reconciled and decided it was a good thing. It would be their first terrestrial project. Now they beached their boat on a rack-lined slope of bushes, tied it off on a dead tree trunk, and walked east over the brush and litter of the abandoned cemetery to where one of Mr. Hexter's folded maps had an X on it. After some hunting around, they concluded that there were few things weirder than an abandoned graveyard. In this case, half brushy meadow and half dank forest, filled with downed branches and trash and row upon row of gravestones, like a miniaturized model of uptown, with the occasional larger monument looming here and there. From time to time, they stopped to read some of the longer inscriptions, but then they came on one memorializing one George Spencer Millet, 1894-1909, whose inscription read, "Lost life by stab in falling on ink eraser, evading 6 young women trying to give him birthday kisses in office Metropolitan Life Building." "Oh, man," Roberto said. "And in our building? That is terrible." "It's like something you would do," Stefan noted. "No way. I just let them kiss me. Shit. He was an idiot." After that, they decided to quit reading inscriptions. They moved on, feeling the heavy stare of all those semi-legible names and lives. There weren't any cemeteries in Lower Manhattan, and they found being in one less fun than they had expected. But then they came on Melville. He was indeed a hefty gravestone, with a scroll carved on it. About 4 feet tall and almost that wide, and a foot or more thick. To each side of the carved scroll were carved leaves on vines, and Melville's name was at the bottom, and therefore almost obscured by mud. It was a dismal place. His wife's stone stood next to his, and on the other side were other family members, including his son Malcolm, who had died young. "It's big," Stefan said. "We should take it back to his neighborhood," Roberto insisted. "No one comes here anymore, you can see that. He's completely forgotten here."
"I don't think so."
"You think it's illegal?"
"I think it's not nice. His body is here, his wife's body, all that. People might come here looking for him and think he got vandalized."
"Well, shit.
Maybe we could find someone else whose grave is underwater now.
Someone else who lived near us? And whose ghost Mr. Hexter saw?"
"No, it would have to be some other someone else. Or maybe we could make memorial signs to put on the buildings around the marina, or on the dock pilings. Or a map. Mr. Hexter would love that. All that stuff he's told us about, Melville, baseball, the Statue of Liberty's hand, all that. We live in a great neighborhood."
"It's true.
But I want to pull something out of the drink. Or the forest. Something we've saved."
"Me too. But maybe Hexter is right. Maybe after the Hussar, it's all downhill."
Roberto sighed.
"I hope not. We're only 12.
"I'm 12. You only think you're 12.
"Whatever. It's too soon to be going downhill."
"We've got to change careers, I guess. Change our focus. You were going to get drowned at some point anyway, so maybe it's a good thing."
"I guess. I liked it, though. And there are jobs down there, like what Vlade did."
"True. But for now, maybe we could look up rather than down. There are those peregrine falcons nesting on the sides of the Flatiron, and lots of others."
"Birds?"
"Or animals. The otters under the docks. Or sea lions. Remember the time sea lions took over the Skyline Marina, and all of them got on one boat and sank it?"
"Yeah, that was cool."
Roberto rubbed his hand over Melville's gravestone, thinking it over. Suddenly it was darker and cooler. A black cloud had come up from the south and was covering the sun. The air was just as steamy, maybe more so, but because of the cloud they were in shade now, and it looked like it would only get cloudier. A big black-bottomed wall of cloud, in fact, rolling in from the south.
"Thunderhead?" Stefan said.
It was too much of a wall to be a thunderhead.
"We better get back."
They hustled back to their boat, untied and hopped in, and headed down the middle of the channel that split the Bronx. The wind was in their face, and they slapped over wave after wave, knocking sheets of water left and right as they crashed down onto the waves' backsides. They ducked down to give the boat a lower profile. Wind and waves both came out of the south, so they could head straight into them. That was lucky, as the tops of the waves were now tumbling forward in the wind, creating major whitecaps. It would have been difficult or impossible to run sideways across waves as high and broken as these. Even heading straight into them was making the boat bounce up hard as it crashed into the whitewater, and they both moved to the back of the boat and sat on each side of the tiller, watching anxiously as the short white walls came rushing at them, and the boat made its improbable tilt and lift. The slushy roar was so loud they had to shout in each other's ears to be heard. The up-tilt in the bow that was built into every Zodiac's design proved their salvation time after time. But even so, waves only a few feet higher would certainly rush right over the bow onto them, or so it seemed. Still, buoyancy was a marvelous thing, and for now they shot up over each wave in turn. And surely the waves couldn't get much bigger, not here in the Harlem River anyway, where they had no fetch to speak of. The boys could hardly believe they were as big as they were, nor that the wind had gotten so strong so fast. Well, summer storms happened. And now they were seeing that the waves did have a bit of fetch, coming up the East River and curving into the Harlem. They were really bouncing hard.
"We should have waited it out,"
Stefan shouted as one particularly big white wall tilted them almost vertically before it passed under them, and the bow then flopped down so hard they had to hold on to avoid being tossed forward.
"We can make it! Maybe we should turn around. I don't know if the stern would rise as well as the bow."
Stefan didn't reply, but it was true.
"Maybe we should take our wrist pad with us next time. Maybe. We'd only ruin it, though. Look at that one coming. I know. Maybe we have to turn. Maybe so. The boat will stay floating even if it's filled with water. We know that. Will the motor keep running if it gets wet? I think so. Remember that time? No. It did one time."
The next big wave shoved them up and back until they were vertical, and they both instinctively threw themselves forward against the bottom to help knock the boat forward. Even so, they hung there upright for a long, sweeping moment, hoping that the wave wouldn't capsize them backward and dump them in the Royal. Instead, the boat flopped forward again and slid fast down the backside of the wave. But more were coming. Big white walls, and the wind was howling.
"Okay, maybe we should come about. We don't want to capsize." "No." "Okay, so..."
Roberto was staring ahead, round-eyed. Seeing his look, Stefan grew afraid. All the waves were about the same distance apart, just as always with waves. They had 7 or 8 seconds between each impact. It wasn't a lot of time to turn around, but they couldn't afford to get caught crossways.
"Next one," Roberto said. "I'll start the turn as soon as the crest is under us. Toward you." "Okay."
The next wave was about the same size as all the others. Not a monster, but close enough. It lifted them. The boat tilted nearly upright. They threw themselves forward. As the bow dropped forward under the impact of their bodies, Roberto twisted the tiller toward Stefan. And as the boat slid down the backside of the wave, he gunned the motor to its max. The boat turned sharply. It was impressively tight, but not super fast, and the next wave was coming. Nothing to do but watch the disaster unfold. The broken wall of water hit when they were about 3/4 turned to it, and Roberto pulled on the tiller so that as the boat skidded forward, it straightened in orientation to the wave, the stern rising slower than the bow had. They were in the broken foam, and it seemed they would be swamped, but aside from a splashing, they were spared, as the boat was buoyant and the wave orderly. The boat rode this wave for a while, and then the wave passed under them, and they were motoring back toward the Bronx at full speed, pushed by the wind and shoved time after time by the broken waves, which passed just barely under them, splashing them but not swamping them, the waves moving somewhat faster than the boat. But they weren't getting swamped, and the Bronx shallows, with all their cluttered broken buildings and rooftops, were quickly approaching. It was a field of waves and bubbles and black roof reefs and white lines of foam, and looked horrible. But they could dart in some gap, then quickly get into the lee of something protruding from the water. And the waves would quickly dampen as they moved into the wreckage of the burrow.
"We're going to make it," Roberto declared.
It was the first thing he had said since they came about, many waves ago.
"Looks like it," Stefan agreed. "But what then?" "We wait it out."
Part 7. The More the Merrier. One invests affection in places where it will be safe when the winds blow, observed Mencken.
A. Vlade. As part of his job, Vlade kept the NOAA weather page for New York up on one of his screens, in a box next to the tide screen. In fact, it was the weather's effect on the tides that interested him, because tides mattered to the building. Beyond that, he didn't really care what the weather was doing. But for a week or more, he had been tracking a hurricane coming up the Atlantic, headed for Florida, it looked like. But now what NOAA was showing caught his full attention. This Hurricane Fyodor had just in the last few hours veered hard northward, and now it looked like it was going to hit the New York area. Its whole run, it had looked like it was heading for North Carolina at the very north end of its impact zone, but now it was trouble for sure. Hurricanes had struck New York several times in the past, but never since the second pulse. Vlade had a page in his files for stormproofing the building, and he called it up on his main screen and alerted his team, all hands on deck. The to-do list was long, and they would have to hurry. Not a drill, Vlade told his team. They had a couple of days at most. It was a lesson never to trust the NOAA modelers when it came to something this important, something he should have learned before. Their models had been getting really good, but strange things still happened. He was leaving his office to get started on the stormproofing when he recalled that Amelia Black was out there in the air somewhere nearby, and Idelba was on her barge off Coney Island. Big exposure for both of them. He stopped to call them. Idelba, where are you?
On the Sisyphus, where else?
And where is your fine sea craft? She snorted.
In the Narrows, on my way in.
Ah, good. You saw the storm?
Yep. Looks bad, huh?
Really bad. Where are you going to go?
I'm not sure. I usually pull the barge into Brooklyn and stash it in the Gowanus, but I don't know. The big warehouse on its south side melted, and that was my windbreak.
Do you want to come in here?
The barge won't fit.
Maybe you could leave the barge in the Gowanus and come over here in the tug.
What makes you think your old pile will protect my tug?
We'll be fine. Put it between us and the north building like you did before. It's kind of a private alley for us, and you'd be well protected from the south.
Okay. Maybe we'll do that. Thanks.
Be quick as you can. You don't want to be out when the wind hits.
Duh.
So that could be checked off. Now, Amelia.
Hey, Vlada, what's up?
Amelia, where are you?
I'm up above Asbury Park Marsh.
Have you looked at the weather?
What? It's beautiful. A bit hot and muggy. Invisibility is down for optimum filming, but we're following a pack of wolves who are trying to—
Amelia, how far can you see south?
Maybe 20 miles? I'm at 500 feet.
Do you watch the weather screens?
Sure, but what? Oh. Oh. Okay, wow. I see what you mean.
What was your producer thinking?
I didn't tell them what I was up to. I'm just out here fooling around.
How fast can you get back here?
Well, maybe 3 or 4 hours. Why, do you think?
Yes, I think. Start now and hurry. Go full speed. Otherwise, you're going to be spending the night in Montreal as a best case.
Okay. As soon as these wolves catch the turkeys.
Amelia!
Okay.
So, maybe that was done. Vlade shook his head. Time to attend to the building. This stone wife of his would never talk back to him, but it had actions and reactions that resembled sulking or grooving or all kinds of moods. Now the building was quiet in the heat and seemed tense. He growled and got going. The Met was now around 230 years old, although to Vlade this meant little. The cathedrals of Europe were 1,000 years old, the Acropolis was 2,600 years old, the pyramids 4,000 years old, and so on. Age was not a factor when it came to structural integrity. That was a matter first of design, second of materials. In both cases, the Met had been fortunate. Vlade had no fear that anything could bring the tower down. It was four square and massively reinforced. Unlike the chopsticks, the ridiculous glass splinters immediately to the south of them. Indeed, if either of those stupid toothpicks fell north, they could wreck the Met too, a thought that gave Vlade the creeps. Hopefully, if they fell, it would be in some other direction, although if they fell west, they would crush the Flatiron, a building everyone around the Bacino loved, though Vlade was glad he wasn't its super. All those non-squared walls were a pain, as Ettore was always saying,
especially the narrow point at the north, where dogs had to wag their tails up and down, as Ettore had it. On the other hand, if the chopsticks fell northwest, they would crush across the square itself, cutting their little basin in half with a great mass of crap. Only if they fell east or south would they be no problem for the Madison Square group, although no doubt the damage in the fall zone would be severe. Alas, one had to hope they would keep standing. He stood on the farm floor, looking south between the splinters. Wind was already pouring through the farm and flailing the green leaves of the crops. The corn would soon lodge, and Heloise and Manuel and other farmers were busy putting up storm shutters across the south side's open windows. But these, of course, were vulnerable to lodging themselves.
"People," Vlade said to them peremptorily, "this is a hurricane coming, a big one. Winds well over 100 miles an hour.
So what do we do?"
"We have to storm shutter all four sides, otherwise we'll get vacuumed. We should strengthen the shutters from behind, too. We've got today to do it, looks like, from the forecast."
Heloise said, "We've only got enough shutters for two sides, maybe three."
Vlade frowned. "Let's do the south, east, and west walls."
They got to work, shuttering the farm's tall, open arches. This was no easy task, and few of them had ever done it, so Vlade had to educate people to the system. The panels were like greenhouse windows, translucent rather than transparent, and made of graphene layers such that they were extremely strong and light. While they were screwing these in place, he kept looking south to see if he could see the storm, and talking on the wrist to the rest of his crew, all working hard on other chores. Around him, he could see that all the skyscrapers in the city had crews engaged in similar work. It seemed like the sky bridges were going to be vulnerable. The bridges were strong, but their attachments to their buildings would be tested. Probably a lot of docks were going to be torn off, too. With the farm shuttered, he attended to the strong possibility they were going to lose power. Their batteries were charged, generator fuel topped up, the photovoltaic sheathing and paint on the building as clean as it could be, and the storm would presumably wash it even cleaner. So even at the height of the storm, the building itself would provide some power, as would the tide turbines down at the waterline. All good, but not enough. So Vlade joined a conference call with the local gridmaster, who was coordinating plans for various flex contingencies across the board, from total retention to complete loss, with the latter possibility taking up most of the talk. Who had what if they were the sole generators? Did anyone have enough to shove some juice back to the local node at the 29th and Park Station, which would then spread it around to those in need? Well, not really. The worst-case scenario was every building fending for itself in a total loss after the juice from the local station was drained. Hopefully that wouldn't happen, or wouldn't last for long. Every building was semi-self-sufficient, at least in theory, but it was surprising how short a time they could go without extra power. Take the stairs, eat cold food, light candles, sure. But what about sewage? What about potable water? Their photovoltaic power would have to be devoted to those functions, and maybe to one elevator. But these were the concerns of people in a strong building, rated 80 or above in the self-sufficiency scales. The neighborhood was good in that regard. Most buildings around Madison Square and in the Lemus, more generally, were strong. But not all of them, and there were many other neighborhoods much weaker than theirs. And when push came to shove, the people in wrecked buildings were going to have to be taken care of if they didn't want hundreds of bodies fouling the canals. To put it at its most practical level. Vlade didn't say that out loud, but other supers did. This was New York, after all.
"If you die, your body rots in my water supply, so get a fucking grip."
This was a direct quote. He didn't want to know who said it. Could have been anybody.
He had already thought it. Everybody had. Nothing to do but take care of your own part of the problem, as someone else had pointed out to that speaker, as in, mind your own business, fuckhead. A call came in.
Vlade, it's Amelia.
He was on the pig's floor above the farm. It was windy, the sky to the south a weird green, a green infused with black. He looked out a window and scanned the horizon to the southwest, saw nothing. Visibility was poor, a kind of pulsing murk. All air traffic had disappeared from the sky. Where are you? He said.
I'm outside the Narrows over Staten Island.
He peered that direction, saw nothing.
Why so slow?
I've been going as fast as I can, but now I can't get any eastness. The wind is too strong from that way.
Damn it, Amelia, this is going to be big. Do you understand?
Of course I do. I can see it. I'm in it already.
Shit. Okay, then run north ahead of it. Don't try to come here. Run north.
But it's so windy.
Yeah, so if you can get down before it's blowing too hard, get down. Anywhere. If the landing situation doesn't look good, just let it run you north until it blows out. Don't try to fight it. In fact, go as high as you can. Get above the turbulence and you can just ride it out.
But I don't want to ride.
Doesn't matter what you want now, gal. You put yourself in this situation. At least you don't have any bears on board. Or do you?
Vlade!
Don't Vlade me. Deal.
He got back to the building prep. Water tanks full, new life straw filters at their bottoms. They could keep water quality for a while with just rain and a gravity feed. Sewage tanks empty, batteries charged, pantries stocked, or at least not empty. Candles and lanterns. Test the generators, check fuel supplies. Get all the boats inside and racked. Empty the dock, and as far as securing the dock, well, shit. He joined the other Madison supers over on the Flatiron dock to talk it over. They were mostly in agreement. The docks were fucked. Best chance would be to tie them to buildings with hawsers that would give them a little bit more play than usual, but not too much. Hope they would just bounce on the waves and hold together. The supers on the north side of the Bacino were aware that they were at the fetch of their little rectangular basin, so that their docks might serve as cushions for their buildings, take some hits from detritus, or they might turn into battering rams hammering the south exposures. Nothing to be done about that, but see what happened. The satellite photos showed that the leading edge of Hurricane Fyodor was 18 miles south of New York.
Let's get everything we can off the farm floor, Vlade said to his team. Shutters or not, move the plant boxes into the big elevators if they'll fit, leave them in the hallways downstairs, also all the hydroponics.
Idelba and her tug arrived, which was a relief, and when they were tied off on 24th between the Met and North, he put her crew to work helping on the farm floor. He had tried to keep the plant boxes modular there, mostly for watering purposes, but now it turned out useful in another way, as they could detach square pot after square pot and fit them in the freight elevator. The hotelos were easy. They were basically tents meant to move. The occupants were harder to move than the hotelos.
Where will we go? Where will we go?
Shut up and move. We'll figure it out later. Go to the dining hall for now. Put your stuff here by the elevators.
The halls on the floors below were looking like a garden shop going out of business sale, unexpected and unhappy.
Fuck, Vlade kept saying. Clean this shit up, come on, make sure there's a throughway, what do you think?
He ran into Idelba down at his office when he was passing through to check the weather screen and his to-do lists.
So where are those two kids?
Idelba asked. Vlade felt his stomach drop.
Stefan and Roberto?
No, those other kids you take care of.
Fuck that, how should I know?
She regarded him.
I don't know, he said. I figured they were in the building or the neighborhood. They take care of themselves. They're always around.
Except when they're not.
Vlade called their wrist pad and got no answer. He and Adelba went to the dining hall and asked Hexter about them. Hexter was looking worried.
I don't know. They aren't answering their wrist, he said. They were going to go up to the Bronx and look for Melville's grave, and they were supposed to be back by now.
The three of them looked at each other.
They'll be okay, Adelba said. They'll hunker down somewhere. They're not stupid.
Don't they have wrist pads?
They have one, but they keep taking it off when they go do things because they keep wrecking it, and also we've been using it to monitor them.
Shit.
A few moments of grim silence, and then they moved on to the chores at hand, leaving Hexter to call Edgardo and some other acquaintances to see if they had seen the boys. Vlade went back up to the top of the building and made sure everything under the cupola was secured, feeling as grim as Quasimodo. The boys were missing, and Amelia was flying the storm in a blimp. Probably they would be okay, but they were exposed in a way they wouldn't be if they were here. He would so much rather have had them here. The building was bombproof. The building would endure, even if the farm floor got deshuttered and stripped clean as a whistle. There was nowhere else he was as sure about, not in the whole Great Bay, not in the whole world. The building would be fine, but some of his people weren't there. Adelba could read him well enough to see this when he got back down to his office, and she paused to touch his arm.
It's okay, she said. They'll be okay.
He nodded heavily. They both knew it wasn't always true. Then the day got very dark, the sky black, the air under it green. Vlade took the elevator back up to the cupola, then climbed the spiral stairs to the blimp room, where narrow windows gave a view from as high as the building afforded. This got him just above the top of the chopsticks, which was pleasing. The Freedom Tower and the Empire State poked above the general murk of the lower city. Farther north, the uptown superscrapers had seemingly coalesced into a single Gothic spire, elongated surreally. Hoboken and Brooklyn Heights were similarly dark and spiky. The rain was coming down now out of dark gray clouds, falling so hard it covered the windows with a wavery sheet of water that sometimes allowed him to see the city fairly well. The Empire State looked like he had never seen it before. He even had trouble comprehending the sight. So much rain was hitting its south side that it had become an immense waterfall dropping right out of the clouds. The thickest part of this fall of white water poured down the vertical inset that scored the middle of the tower's south side, but really, the entire south surface was white water, no building visible at all except the very top of the spire.
Wow! Vlade shouted. Holy God!
He wished there were someone there with him to witness it, and he even called Adelba to tell her to come up, but she was busy down below with something. Now, the wind became both a low, ripping roar and a high keening, blended across the octaves to make a curdling, superhuman shriek. The East River was white-capped, and he could now see the Hudson in a way that he usually couldn't from up here because it, too, was white. Both appeared to be running hard north, like rapids. Below him he could see the western half of the Bacino, and it too was white-capped, the waves rolling south to north and leaving trails of white bubbles on black water. The dock at the northwest corner was slamming up against its restraints over and over, jerking at its high point like some mad dog rushing against its leash. Something in that system would break soon. The sight of it confirmed to him that many of the docks on the Hudson would be getting torn off.
The wind was now so strong it was wiping his windows clean and giving him brief, clear views of the city, which blurred over and over as freshet spewed down. Really, the south side of the Empire State had to be seen to be believed, and even then it was unbelievable. He wished that the super there would defy the storm with the building's light show. Under the wall of water, it would look crazy. Then it occurred to him that the 33rd Street Canal under the Empire State must be like the bottom of Niagara Falls. He couldn't see a single boat or ship anywhere, which made sense and was good, but it looked weird, too. End of the world. New York, empty, abandoned to the elements, which were now howling in triumph at their victory. Then the lights in the cupola flickered and went out, and he cursed and clicked his wrist pad to the building's control center. Nothing came up until the generators kicked in, which they were programmed to do automatically. Then the lights came back on. Even so, it would be imprudent to get in an elevator now. So he cursed again and began the long, painful task of descending the stairs. When he got down the tight spiral staircases of the cupola to the real stairwell behind the elevator, the generators seemed to be working well. Everything was still lit, and he was tempted to take the elevator to save time and his knees. But it would be a disaster to get caught in a stuck elevator, so he thumped down methodically. 40 painful stories later, he was down in the control room, and there, everything was okay, except for two problems. Their generators could only run for about 3 days before they would have used up their fuel, and the storm surge pouring in the narrows, which the tide screen showed was already an astonishing 10 feet above the normal high tide, would, if it continued very long, raise sea level in the city to the point where their boathouse room would be flooded above the level of its ceiling. The water would therefore ascend the open stairs to the floor above, where many of the building's working rooms were. This was where one had to locate some of the building's functions for them to operate most efficiently. There was no way to fully close the boathouse off from the bacino itself, which was something Vlade promised himself to change in the future. So water would get in from the canal under its door to the water inside, and the boathouse would fill precisely as high as the storm surge went.
"We'll have to close off the boathouse here on the inside and just let the water fill it all the way to its top," he said to Sue and the others in the control room. Sue was already packing up stuff in the drawers. Closing off the boathouse would save them from anything but leaky seals, which they could deal with. The boats in the boathouse would be lifted and knocked around a bit, mostly into each other. If it was an orderly rise of water, perhaps it wouldn't wreak too much damage. Then, power. He went down the list and shut off power to everything but the absolute necessities, after informing everyone in the building over the intercom.
"People, we're cutting power to everything but essential services to save fuel. Seems like the grid might be out for a while."
This cut their power use to about 13% of normal, which was great. And he could get on the wrist and see what the local power plant was dealing with. It was a hardened system, a flexible grid. A lot of power was generated by the buildings themselves, and they all poured whatever extra they had into the local plant, which then banked it with flywheels and hydro and batteries, and later on could put some back out to those who called for it. Very good as such, although clearly this was going to test the system hard, but at least no part of it was located in basements anymore. He had turned off most of the building's heat and air conditioning and lighting, and so people began to congregate in the dining hall and common floor. Of course, it was possible to stay in one's rooms and watch the storm by lantern or candlelight, and a fair number of residents reported that they were doing that, but many came down to join the others on the common floor. It was a social thing, as everyone acknowledged, a party of sorts, or a taking of refuge, a danger to be endured together, a marvel to be marveled at. The dining room windows faced south and west, and water fell off the side of the building and obscured the view, and though it was nothing like as astonishing as the Empire State's south face, it was still like being in a cave behind a waterfall. The roar of the wind and rain filled everything, and as people had to shout to be heard, they shouted all the more to surmount their own din, in the usual party style, until Vlade felt like it was time to get back to the relative quiet of the control room. Here, however, it was disturbing in a different way. It was quiet, but strangely so, as the window between his office and the boathouse was looking like the side of an aquarium. The water level inside the boathouse was now 15 feet higher than normal high tide. Vlade got next to the window and fearfully looked up. It was just possible to discern the water level, up there near the ceiling, crowded with the hulls of boats from the lowest two levels of his sling rafters, all banging around up there in the surface slop together. Not a happy sight, and if the door seals leaked too badly, his office would get flooded and impede the operation of the building. Already there was water seeping in under the door. He cursed at the sight and got to work sealing the door with a sealant foam he often used for just that purpose. It would clean up with a solvent later, and for now it would work well. It was hard to imagine how the city would do with a storm surge this high. Sea level had been mostly stable for 40 years, and although there were always neap tides and storm surges, everyone had gotten used to a watermark that was now being far exceeded. The damage would be huge. All those careful and difficult first-floor-off-the-water designs, the trickiest part of the Venusification of the city, would be wrecked. And every entrance to the submarine world would be overtopped as well, so that all the laborious aeration could be lost to flooding, a huge disaster. Hopefully the hatches, like big manhole covers on hinges, that had been installed at every opening, would all be closed and working well. And there were internal bulkheads as well that might limit any floods that did occur. But it was a dangerous situation, and anyone still down there was going to be stuck for the duration of the surge. Well, possibly they could get to some of the submarine entries that were inside buildings. It would be interesting to hear the stories once it was all over. For now, he was locked out of his boathouse, and if he had wanted to go out somewhere, which, happily, he didn't, he would have had to use an inflatable and make some kind of emergency window-breaking egress. That was bizarre, nerve-wracking. Hopefully nothing worse than that. The sky bridge to north was in the lee of the Met, and it seemed like it was protected enough from the brunt of the wind to suffer no harm. This was a blessing, because every bridge that ripped out would tear a hole in the building it came out of, and that hole would then be injected with wind and water. He wanted to go back up to the tower's cupola to see if he could tell how the sky bridges were doing, but he felt it would be an indulgence, not to mention 40 floors of stairs, both up and down. Possibly he should power up one elevator for those really in need. But first, he should check on the sky bridge to north, and north itself. So he left Sue in charge and told his group to call him if anything happened, and walked up the stairs to the 6th floor, where the sky bridge connected. It had a little entry chamber of its own, an airlock of sorts, great for keeping the building warm and dry. He opened the first door, and the world roared. He felt a little scared to open the 2nd door to the sky bridge proper, though typically he regarded it as a kind of room of its own, skinny and long. He opened the door, and it got even louder. The noise, a kind of howl with a subsonic element, picked up the hair on the back of his neck. He spoke into his wrist to tell his people where he was going, and couldn't hear himself. Hesitantly, he stepped out onto the sky bridge. Flailing rainwater obscured the views of the narrow canal between the 2 buildings,
but he could see Idelba's big tug below, still tied off to both buildings and looking good, though higher than he was used to, both because of the size of the tug and the height of the water. The black surface of the canal was chopped into a chaos of wave interference, the black water heavily scalloped by wind ruffles, the big scallops each scalloped themselves at smaller scales. Truly, the water didn't know where to go under the pressure of the blast swirling back and forth over the canal. They were in a lee, so the main brunt of wind was baffled, but it was still strong. There were downdrafts that struck so hard they knocked spray off the canal into the air. He could feel the sky bridge vibrating under him, though there was no rocking or swaying. It was well protected by the Met. Inside North, it was quieter. It wasn't fronting the blast, but rather taking side slaps and vacuum suckings. The residents there were mostly gathered in their own common room and dining hall, and again it was dim through most of the building. North didn't have a boathouse, so they didn't have that problem. Their dock door was sealed shut. All seemed well. North's original design as the foundation for a tower taller than the Empire State Building meant it was immensely strong. It would be fine. Vlade recrossed the skybridge, pausing out in the middle to look around again. To the west he could see out into the Bacino, and it was wild. The surface of the little rectangular lake was getting ripped away and flung whitely northward. It wasn't possible to see the water surface itself, as the whiteness over it filled the air, but occasional glimpses confirmed that its level was far higher than normal, amazingly higher, like the third pulse had come at last. The roar was immense. Feeling spooked and awed, Vlade got back into the Met. Now they were settling in with the idea that it was going to be a test of endurance between them and the storm. They had limited food, power, potable water, and sewage space. Food was the least self-sustaining, but they had a stock of dried and canned and frozen, and the PV power would keep their refrigerators going. They did have some resilience, and the storm could only go on for so long. Although the aftermath would be problematic. Vlade passed some time tapping out various scenarios on his spreadsheets, using Gantt programs to see how they might do. Well, it seemed they could go for a week at least. It would help if their local power station could send them some electricity. The node network for the power grid work was robust. He began to check around. The 28th power station was still connected to its clients in the neighborhood, but not out to the big power plants north of the city. They were identifying the point of the break now and would get out and repair it when they could. Could be a while, they said. That was for sure. The other buildings in the neighborhood were mostly okay, but one of the Bishop sky bridges between the Decker building and the new school had come down over 5th and 14th. And both buildings were now coping with open holes in their sides, just as Vlade had expected. That was apparently just one of about a dozen sky bridges that had pulled out in Lower Manhattan alone. Bishop bridges were doing worse than Rook bridges. North-South Rooks were doing worse than East-Wests because the wind was a bit more east than south. If they pulled out at one end but not the other, they fell into the building they were still connected to, breaking windows, and so on. Windows were breaking frequently anyway, just by getting blown in or sucked out. The top of the Empire State had just a half hour earlier recorded a gust of 164 miles an hour. One of the super scrapers uptown, with an eye of the needle near its top, had reported winds of 190 miles per hour through the eye, which had been included in the building's design precisely to reduce wind pressures against its uppermost surfaces. The average speed over Manhattan right now, NOAA said, was 130 miles per hour. Incredible,
Vlade said when he saw that. As far as he knew, he had never seen a wind over 100, and that, too, had been in a hurricane. He had been 24 at the time, and he and some friends had gone out into the wind to see what it felt like. This was on Long Island, and they had been blown flat onto the sand of Jones Beach and crawled around, laughing their heads off, until his friend Oscar broke his wrist.